What's up, Atlanta soccer fam? If you're like me, you've already given up on that weight loss New Year's resolution thing you started 2017 with. The good thing is, it's still early enough to pretend you've been at it since January 1. That's where CrossFit Vesuvio and Atlanta Strength and Conditioning comes in. If you've been thinking about hopping on that CrossFit bus, there's no better time than now and no better place than with CrossFit Vesuvio and Atlanta Strength and Conditioning. Right now, they're running a fantastic deal to both Terminus Legion members and anyone that listens to the Mouths of South podcast. Tell the owner, Christo, you heard it on the Mouths of South podcast, and get what normally comes with an $185 price tag for $135. And this is the unlimited membership, all CrossFit and powerlifting classes, a variety of different class times. And CrossFit Vesuvio is an award-winning CrossFit gym, Creative Loafing's Best of Atlanta, Best Self Magazine 2016 Best CrossFit Gym in Atlanta. And I hear Atlanta United players are training there at least until the training facilities in Marietta are completed. That's how reputable this gym is. 1642 Powers Ferry Road, Southeast, Suite 100, 30067 in Marietta. Give them a call at 678-631-6315 and visit them online at CrossFitVesuvio.com. Tell them Mouths of the South sent you.
Hello, hello. This is Fernando Fiore, El Presidente. And you are listening to the Mouths of the South podcast on VerySouthSucker.com. You're it.
This is the Mouths of the South podcast. Matt Doyle joining us now on the Mouths of the South podcast.
And Alexi Lalas joins us right now,
bringing you the best coverage of Atlanta United FC. Paul Tenorio joining us now. Kristen Hennage on the Mouths of the South podcast.
The president of Atlanta United FC, Darren Eels.
Happy to have Doug Robertson on the Mouths of the South podcast. AJC writer for Atlanta United. The biggest names and exclusive interviews on the Mouths of the South podcast.
They'll do it again soon.
My pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you having me on.
Let's go.
Almiron here with the ball through to Villalba. Villalba! Atlanta United take the lead. 15 minutes in at BMO Field.
This is Vasquez. Into the path of Altidore. Lovely ball for Sebastian Giménez. Sebastian Giménez has his first goal of the season. And Toronto FC are level. 20 minutes in at BMO Field. This is Vasquez. Into the path of Altidore. Lovely ball for Sebastian Giménez.
Finger trying to get the challenge in, but it's finished superbly by Villalba. It's his second of the game, and Atlanta United tie it up within 90 seconds of the second half kickoff.
What's up, Atlanta? This is the Mouths of the South podcast. I'm Eric Quintana, and with me is Josh Bagrianski. Sam and Jason off tonight. We gave them a well-deserved night off. No, I'm just kidding. Sam had some business to take care of. Jason is handling Baby Is a Smith. And Josh is with me here today. Josh, what's going on?
Good to be with you, man. Hey, it was great to actually have the whole, well, minus Jason, but have the whole crew together on Saturday night, watch the game, have a couple beers. Good to be with y'all.
Oh, it's so much better when it's all live, right? It's all live and in person and all that good stuff.
And, man, the atmosphere at Fadeau.
Impressive.
It's just so cool to see the city embracing the sport and it's not just Fadeau. I mean, all over the city, you know, I'm seeing Atlanta United jerseys at post-match, and it's just so cool as for people like us who have followed the game for so long, just to see all these other people falling in love with it. It's great. It's great.
I hear from people all the time who didn't give soccer or Atlanta United a chance in this city, and they are more than impressed with what's going on, as is everyone. I mean, you look at the numbers by themselves and the way that people are reacting to this team, and it's pretty obvious what's going on. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see it. But I'm hearing from people who traditionally don't care, don't like soccer, didn't give it a chance, and were the people that were, okay, you know, soccer in Atlanta again, you know, we'll wait and see if this really sticks this time.
Right.
So I think people are getting that different perspective, different idea as to what this team not only means to Atlanta, the soccer community, the sports community as a whole, because you're looking at possibly the second best right now team, at least in my opinion. I think if you're to, I know you're comparing literally two different sports, literally apples and oranges. But if you're talking one better than the other one, I like Atlanta over the Hawks, which would put them in second underneath the Falcons, who obviously just went to the Super Bowl and all that good stuff. But
Yeah, and it's just the product in general. I mean, the way that they play, and in terms of what you were saying, people really embracing the team. The great thing for me is it's everybody. It's people who have never watched before. It's people like us who will, you know, go watch a match anywhere, anytime.
It's people who said soccer is boring who are now looking at Atlanta United and the way they play and think, oh my gosh, those games are exciting.
Yeah, and even the people who, and I'm not a huge fan of this opinion, but the people who are like, oh, I won't watch MLS, you know, it's not high enough quality.
Yeah, get out
all
of here,
them. Say, oh, but even those folks, you know, are just love it, saying, wow, this is a great style of play. I'm really enjoying watching this team play. So I mean, they've got everybody on board.
All right. Well, this is the day after show, so we had our post game show, which as you know, we do a pre and post game before every match before every away match at Fadeau Irish Pub in Buckhead. And we also try to do a day after show, and the post game show is for the instant reaction. We are watching those games as fans, much like you are at home or at Fadeau or at Brewhouse or wherever you might be watching the game. And so we want to give you that instant reaction. We want to give you the chance to call in and give your instant reaction. This is the day after show. This is where we rewatch the match. And we look at it from a more analytical aspect. We look at the little small details we might have missed watching it the first time. For example, did you know that one of the Toronto SC players probably should have been given a red card way before Yamil Assad got his red card? We'll talk about that in a little bit. One thing that I think many people are going to gloss over and not think much of, and this is very, very important, the Falcons preseason schedule came out today. And it was interesting, the placement of their home games. And you have to kind of connect the dots. I'm not really good at math, but I do know that 1 + 1 = 2. So
that's correct.
So when I see that the Atlanta Falcons, their preseason schedule, which ends on August 31st, which means that the third game is probably going to be around August 20th to 23rd, something like that. Maybe even a little bit later. But when you have both games kind of at the back end of that preseason schedule, on top of the fact that the stadium, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, is going to, at this point, seemingly undergo another delay because of the roof situation, it leads me to believe that the Atlanta Falcons don't think this stadium is good. They want to give themselves enough time in the event that this stadium is not completed by the first preseason game. They want to give themselves a little extra wiggle room. You don't do that if you're not confident about the completion date of the stadium, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I look at that and I think they're a little wishy-washy as to when this thing's actually going to get completed. And on top of that, I've learned that the way this whole roof situation works, it seems as though at this point, they either have to cut off the roof and worry about it later, or build it really, really fast and figure out how to make this roof work before the NFL season. I'm not even talking about Atlanta United at this point. I'm just talking about the NFL season. That's ultimately what matters most in terms of a revenue perspective, which
gotcha.
Sports is a revenue-generating business. Don't get mixed up about that.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this last week, Eric. As Atlanta United fans, we have to kind of accept that the Falcons is where the bread is buttered. And certainly there would never.
The Falcons are how Atlanta United has been able to pay for everything it's been able to pay for this season.
Probably why we have Atlanta United in the first place. So we have to get that.
At least one of the reasons.
Yeah, of course. I guess my question, and Eric, you're kind of more tapped in with sources certainly than I am. I'm just a season ticket holder that loves the game. One of the things that concerns me as a fan, for me personally, I'm going to be there. You know, I will watch. They have got me no matter where they're playing. I love the game. I love the sport. To have a professional team in town like this is awesome. But you've got people who, first of all, were just buying season tickets to Atlanta United this season. And they're, some of them are bought in, yes, because they love the product. But you had people who bought tickets because that's the only way they could afford to get in Mercedes-Benz in the first place.
Yep.
So we saw, you know, with the initial delay going into the season that the club did some things for season ticket holders and fans, some things to kind of appease them. But if this goes into August, like you're saying, how does Atlanta United save face here?
Well, the only thing I can say is, and I'm looking specifically at, I think it's ESPN's coverage. It might be, they might have taken this from the AJC.
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry, Bob McClure, who I actually saw today. Week three, which would be the first home preseason game for the Atlanta Falcons, is against the Arizona Cardinals. It is tentatively scheduled for a date between August 24th and August 27th. The fourth preseason game is, again, tentatively scheduled between August 31st and September 1st. That is another month delay that we're looking at.
Wow.
If we're talking about another, if we're talking about another, potentially another month, we're looking at trying to either hoping that Atlanta United has a contingency plan with Georgia Tech, or they got to find another place to play.
Yeah, and from what I've read,
that is the smallest of issues they're going to have to deal with, is finding a, that's one of the smaller issues they're going to have to deal with, considering everything else is about that I'm about to mention. That is not the most important factor. It is an important factor, finding a place to play, obviously. But what do you do about the season ticket holders?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's really, really the big issue. I mean, and we're talking about a record amount of season ticket holders. So I don't really know what they do. And you've got a large group of folks like me, and I've mentioned this before. I don't care, man. I'm going to the game. I'm loving it.
There's a lot of people like you. A lot of people in the supporter section. Just give me a place to stand, and I'm there.
Yeah.
It's the people. You know what? Go ahead. Sorry.
So it's fine. You don't get to that many season ticket holders of all you know, crazy ultra soccer fans or whoever that really know the game. You've got a lot of people that are new to this, and you're trying to get them to buy in long term to your product. And what you're putting on the pitch is great, but if there's not a pitch to play on, and of course there's going to be a pitch to play on, but when things like that become an issue, it creates a sense of instability in the organization that I actually don't think is there. You don't think is there. It doesn't look like it's there. But to a casual fan that's just kind of arriving and starting to watch, these types of things do not look good for the organization at all.
For the casual fan, having bought season tickets, expecting to be in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, then being, you know, the home field being switched to Bobby Dodd kind of as quickly as it was, I think a lot of people accept, and especially after Atlanta United came out and gave, you know, gave the reimbursements, gave all the perks for those season ticket holders, I think everyone was pleased at not only the fact that Atlanta United kind of did right by most of the fans, but Georgia Tech has turned out to be a fantastic venue for Atlanta United, at least in the first however many games end up playing there. Now, the lines to the bathrooms, the line to concession stands, the actual price for the concession stands, the parking, I understand it's all a huge issue, and I understand that is something that I don't have to deal with, so I'm not going to pretend like I know what people in the supporter section, what season ticket holders typically have to go through. I'm sure it sucks. Mercedes-Benz Stadium would obviously have offered an alternative to all that, a better alternative to all that, in the sense that, you know, you had the cheap food as a selling point. You had the refillable drinks as a selling point. You had the million bathrooms as a selling point. You had the fact that it was going to be inside and not in you know, wait until we get into summer when it's really, really hot. The fact that you were going to be at least in a semi-closed building away from that scorching heat in the summer. You weren't going to have
affordable.
To... Affordable, exactly. All that played into why people who aren't supporter section people, and you can't just automatically discount their fandom, their supportership just because they're not sitting in the supporter section. I have a friend, for example, who loves Atlanta United, is sitting right next to the supporter section, but he didn't want to sit in the supporter section because he was going to bring his wife, and his wife is as much of a soccer fan as she is. She's not going to stand the entire time. He actually doesn't like the fact that they stand the entire time now at Georgia Tech. It's just kind of the nature of what's happened, and sure, it looks great on TV, and people have taken notice of it, but you don't see – that's not normal. And there's not normal for a reason. There's a reason they're standing the entire game, is because no one can see with the sight lines that Georgia Tech has right now. No one can see the end lines. No one can see the corners because the people in front are standing up. The people behind them are standing up, and so on and so forth. It's not supposed to be like that. The supporter section, sure, stand all you want, cheer all you want, be as loud as you want. That's fine. you're not affected by this. By wherever Atlanta United plays, you don't care. That's fine. They don't. Atlanta United, for lack of a better term, isn't worried about you. They're worried about, they should be worried about, how they handle the season ticket holders that bought season tickets specifically for a Mercedes-Benz Stadium and quite possibly, for example, I had one person tell me today, I probably wouldn't expect any games at Mercedes-Benz Stadium this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not something he would tell me lightly, this person. And I have no, he said he has very reliable sources.
But surely the Falcons will play. Would it be the Falcons can and Atlanta United can't?
No. Here's the thing. I think there's a contingency plan for the two preseason games that are supposed to be at home.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a contingency plan for those games, then, and I've heard contingency plans about those two home games as far back as like January.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything that, this is not Atlanta United's fault. This is the construction crews, because you can't blame it on the weather, you can't blame it on, everything was supposed to go right. And a couple, I think two really, really big errors have set this stadium back quite significantly, and it's looking like it's going to cost Arthur Blank a pretty penny. It's looking like it might cost Atlanta United a pretty penny. I'm sure the Atlanta Falcons are going to hear it from a lot of people, including the NFL, as to what the hell. I wonder if the 2018 Super Bowl situation is going to be changed. I mean, if they have to forego the roof altogether for at least one season, does that affect what happens with the Super Bowl bid?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those are all things you got to take into account that have nothing to do with Atlanta United.
This is big, big money here.
Yeah,
big money.
On top of that, you're looking at college football starting, I think, two games in Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Yeah, Chick-fil-A kickoff. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And just based off of what I've heard on the radio, and this is a guy that is well-connected in Chuck Oliver at 680 The Fan, well-connected, who has openly said on the radio that he's talked to representatives or people within the school who are playing in those Chick-fil-A kickoff games, and they said they pretty much better have that stadium done.
I can't imagine. I mean, what a disaster. Like I said, that's big, big money stuff there. And that's, like we said, that's what Arthur Blank, that's what everyone's really worried about. Atlanta United, they want to get him in there and certainly need to appease the season ticket holders somehow. But if this thing is not open for SEC, ACC matchups, week one of the college football season, for NFL games, for all the other things the stadium can be used for, it's just going to be a complete mess. One thing I wanted to ask you, Eric. So say that the date gets pushed back for Atlanta United. For sure we're in Bobby Dodd still?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, where else is there to really go?
I'm sure
I know they're paying a pretty penny they had the field redone and everything.
I asked Darren Eales, I think before, and I wish I had the interview cause I'd play his answer. I'd have to go find it. Mm. Maybe I can, but, I remember asking him if there's a contingency plan for, I think it was in the last interview we had with him on the podcast, if there's a contingency plan for Atlanta United in case Mercedes-Benz gets delayed again. For any reason, for weather, whatever, and he openly said, "Like, look, we don't predict any more delays. The last time we had him on, but you know, you can't predict the weather, you can't predict, you know, certain circumstances. It's out of Atlanta United's control. It's not like Atlanta United is going every day and hammering the Mercedes-Benz together. They're not doing anything. They have nothing, almost nothing, to do with that stadium other than saying
they're probably as frustrated as anyone.
They're probably more frustrated than we are.
Yeah, absolutely,
because they have to deal with all the repercussions. We just sit there and complain. They have to deal with. They have to actually figure out solutions for this stuff. So I feel bad for Atlanta United in the sense that they've got to kind of fix the mess that isn't their mess to begin with.
Yeah.
If that 100%. Makes sense.
Just because the way the calendar lined up, you know, we're the first available event, and the delay is naturally going to affect Atlanta United more. And then, like we said, all at the same time, it's not the biggest priority of all. Of all the things that are going to happen in that venue, so it's got to be very frustrating from Atlanta United's standpoint. And I mean, they might know maybe a little more, or just as much as you do, Eric.
I asked Darren Eales about the contingency plan. He said they didn't have one, but he also left the door open in case something did happen, because we can't predict the future. No one can. So he left the door open just in case, and it looks like. I wonder if there was just kind of an understanding, maybe not a set deal, but just kind of an understanding that in the event that something happens, it wasn't necessarily a contingency plan per se, but they had something worked out for, like, if this, then this. So if Mercedes-Benz Stadium is delayed again, then, you know, we extend this deal for whatever, for as long as we want, or for as long as we need, or whatever. Or they have, or they're planning on playing somewhere else. I don't know what the plan is. I'm hoping to get to, I'm going to the training grounds tomorrow, and I plan on asking a lot of questions about that. So we'll see what kind of answers I get. I don't expect them to reveal much. But considering that they delayed the update to the delay,
yeah,
you got to think that something is in the works now, or has already been in the works, or something like that. I mean, it would suck. I'm not gonna lie, it would suck if we're not in Mercedes-Benz July 30th. Or the other thing I was thinking that might happen, and this would be really bad, because not only are you talking about losing home games, but you're talking about losing the revenue plus the fan support, all that good stuff.
I think one thing
that could happen is, I'm sure this would have to go through MLS and would have to be, it would be unprecedented and all that stuff. But if you look at flipping the home games that are affected by Mercedes-Benz Stadium being delayed again, you flip those home games into away games. I don't see how. Now, the problem with that is season ticket holders get screwed. You'd have to refund all the money for those games back. And you obviously lose a game at home. I doubt that happens.
That's worst case scenario.
Exactly. I think that might be just, we have nothing else we can play. We have no other cards we can play. The deck has been dealt completely. We have nothing left. Here's the only option we have. And as much as that would suck, you know, we did initially think we were going to have, you know, an entire away schedule for the first half of the season. So, you know, we got a bonus in Georgia Tech, but we have no idea what's going to happen. We haven't heard anything definitive from the club, from the Falcons, from anything. We have different set of facts. The two preseason games backloaded with home games for those last 2 weeks that are basically late August. And we know that the roof is causing problems and there's a delay on the delay. There's a delay on the update for the delay, or however you want to phrase that.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Lots of delaying.
It's not good, it's not good, but ultimately we don't know what the situation is. We don't know if really any, I mean, we might have this conversation and then tomorrow realize, yeah, we have a plan. We'll be a Bobby Dodd as long as we need. No worries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have no idea how it would work, but maybe they've got something in the works. I don't know. We'll find out. Hopefully we find out tomorrow, Tuesday. So that's enough about the stadium because we've already gone too long. So we all saw the red card that Yamil Assad was given for his swim move, for lack of a better term. You can debate it all you want. I think by the letter of the law and by how Toronto FC, how they reacted, and how they basically, well, they all watched instant replay on the monitors or on the big screens in the stadium and then told the referee exactly what happened. You can't, if you just caught a glimpse of what happened, like out of the corner of your eye or happened to watch it in real time, you can't deny that he did touch his head. And the swim move, it's not in itself a violent act, but it does look violent in that instance. So if you take the slight, slight rubbing of the elbow on the head, plus the actual movement of basically swimming over the guy's shoulder, it does, by the letter of the law, it is a red card. Now, because the referees didn't see it, in my opinion, they didn't see it. They just saw a guy fall, and then people told the referees what happened, which you should never let the players officiate the games. But that whole situation could have been avoided. We can go back and forth on that. I think, letter of the law, it's a red card. I don't know about you, Josh.
Well, to me, he has to some sort of excessive force with the elbow, so I think it's difficult. But like, if the referee had seen it right away and come straight in with a red, we would be arguing whether it was harsh or not. But since he didn't see it, we can kind of look at it objectively and say, to me, that's not excessive force. But the big thing to me is, aside from the red, is like you said, the way it was handled.
Yeah, it was handled poorly.
I think Dave Ganter and Philippe Briere was the AR. It was absolutely terrible. And it was just, aside from the missed calls, I mean, that is a low quality of refereeing from the entire crew there. That's just terrible. And I guarantee you that they're hearing it from the MLS. I mean, that you cannot handle a situation like that. So you agree with me, Eric, and I've heard that you think that at least the AR saw the replay when they
I don't know if any of the officials saw the replay. I know that the players saw the replay and went and go. I mean, you visibly can go see Josie explaining what happened based off the replay. He didn't see it. No, I don't think many of the actual players. Well, that's a lie.
No one rushed him right away.
Exactly. No, it's not. Everyone knew exactly what happened as soon as who was it? It was was it Morrow? No, it wasn't Morrow. It was who was the guy that actually went down?
Zavaleta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As soon as he went down and people realized, oh my gosh, we could get him red carded, they rushed to the official. They watched it on the big screen and rushed to the official. I'm glad you actually mentioned missed calls, though. Earlier in that half, in like the 54th to 56th minute, I forget which one, Assad dispossesses Vasquez on the right side. And it's ultimately what leads to Tito being able to get down the right side and tries to hit a long through ball to Almiron. It goes too long. Keeper kicks it out of bounds. But in that play, though, you can visibly see Vasquez elbowing Assad in the stomach.
Trucked him. Yeah.
And it looked so much more violent than anything Assad did to earn his red card. And look.
Nothing given.
You can't, because you see the ref point at the spot where Assad is down, meaning I've seen it, I got it. At least that's what I took away from it. I've seen it, I got it. And then, I want to say 20 minutes later, 15 minutes later or so, a similar scenario happens where a player goes down, and I just don't understand how you draw the red card for Yamil when the ref at least saw the end of what happened. Someone else had to have seen what happened. How does no one rush to the official? How does no one stop play and run over to the official to tell him what happened? Because that's an automatic red card. He elbows him in the stomach. I don't know how. If he doesn't get retroactively penalized in some form, then I fully give up on the referees in MLS. I know many people already have, but that's embarrassing. To miss a call like that so blatantly that we can see, I mean, to be honest, I missed it at first too. I never saw it when I was first watching it. But you can see in replays the referee pointing to where Yamil Assad is on the ground, which you would think means I got to go address this. I understand now why Yamil was so upset, because he literally got essentially elbowed in the stomach, and then he goes and does a swim move that barely touches the guy's head, and he gets red carded. I see why he's so upset now. I see why the assistant on Martino's bench got tossed. I guarantee you he's complaining about the same thing.
Oh yeah, and he was probably shocked. I mean, these guys have been with Martino. I mean, they've managed top leagues, and they've seen plenty of missed calls, I'm sure. But it was unprofessional, Eric. I mean, the way that red card was handled was simply unprofessional. Players are going to rush you. Players are going to try to win you over and call that red if they get touched in the head. They're trying to win the game. Your job is to ignore that and call it objectively. And I'll address this in a moment, but it wasn't just that call. There are four or five calls throughout the match where I felt the home crowd and Toronto and just the general pressure affected the refereeing crew, and certainly it all came to a head with that red card in the 75th minute.
Well, and that'll happen, you know, getting the, you know, home cooking and all that good stuff.
That
happens.
Yeah.
That's part of having the home field advantage. But for it to be as lopsided as it seemed, especially that second half, I don't know about that. I mean, there were a lot of incidents. I mean, go ahead and name them, because I just felt like it was very, I've seen worse officiated games. I just thought in the two bigger instances, the referee completely flubbed it.
Yeah, and to me, and it is nothing I really noticed till I went back and rewatched, was the pattern. It was the same type of error. So you may remember the Villalba yellow card in the 15th minute. I think it was
where
just after or before he scored. So he barges into.
He's trying to shoulder.
I think it was Mavinga.
Yeah.
Or Cooper. I think it was Mavinga.
He's trying to shoulder him off the ball.
Yeah, so he was shooting the ball out of play for a goal kick. They'd actually just come together, and Villalba was a little frustrated, and he runs into him with his shoulder, barges him over, knocks him down. Now, he gets a yellow. I actually am cool with that, but the lead-up to the yellow was unbelievable. So the AR actually makes the call, Philippe Briere. He rushes in to separate, really as much ado about nothing. Drew Moore was pretty upset with the challenge from Villalba, comes running and nothing happens. There is, you know, the usual, the players are talking, they're talking to the referee. Then maybe a minute, 30 seconds later, you see the yell come out for Villalba as they're walking away towards the half line. So I don't know why he's taken this long to give him a yellow.
He must have said something.
Well, but I looked and the yellow was not given for dissent. The yellow was given for unsporting conduct. So the yellow was technically given for what the AR called. So if the AR had seen that, he should have communicated that to him immediately. So I don't understand why the yellow comes out later in that sense. In the 39th minute, I just made notes of these. It's unbelievable. There's a play where Jovinko was cutting in from a wide position, and Greg Garza got in front of him, bided him off. Jovinko went down softly. Again, to me, not a foul, but if you blow your whistle right away, it's one thing. About a second and a half, 2 seconds pass, and all of a sudden, and the referee actually starts to run with the ball the other way because Jovinko's lost the ball, Garza's won it, we're going on the attack. You see the referee take two or three steps towards the Toronto goal. He's running back down the field as if nothing has happened. Crowd goes crazy for the foul. He blows it back.
Did you happen to catch the AR and if he raised his flag or not?
Sorry?
Did you happen to catch
No, he did not raise his flag. He did not raise his flag on that. So that call came from the center. And then in the 57th, and again, it's not even that these are huge calls, but it's the pattern of the way they're being missed. So 57th minute, you may remember this. Again, it was just kind of a random moment in the match. There was a very obvious throw-in that should have been awarded to Atlanta where Greg Garza headed the ball off of a Toronto player whose the Toronto player's back was to their official. And Briere, the AR, I don't know how he doesn't see it. He's standing on the touchline, doesn't make a call either way, forcing the center to give it to Toronto. But he was screened. The center couldn't see it. So it was that particular linesman and the center throughout the match clearly being influenced by the home fans, clearly being influenced by the home side, not communicating properly together. And it's no wonder that they missed that call at the end there because they've been making those mistakes the entire match. And you cannot have that at any level of professional soccer. I mean, it legitimately ruined the match over the last 15 minutes, which I think we were in for a grandstand finish. And again, it's not just that there were missed calls. Some of these are actually subjective. I mean, some of these, I understand the result of the call. But the lead up to it and the pattern of the same thing happening over and over again is just awful. And it's embarrassing, to be honest. In terms of the entire crew just dropping the ball in a big, big match. You'd think that they were top. Maybe I should get more up to date on who the top refs are in the MLS, but you would think Atlanta against Toronto in Toronto would get a top crew.
Maybe. I remember one specific instance, and you might have already brought it up, but have you ever played Mario Party?
Oh, yeah, man.
So do you remember the mini game where I forget who, I don't know what the character, but he has two flags, the blue one, I think it's a red one, and he lifts one of them up and you have to you have to push whichever button matches that specific flag.
Of course.
As quickly as you can. So there was one instance where the referee, the ball's out, and again, this might be one you're already referring to, but the referee, he obviously has no idea whose ball it is. He's waiting for the AR to make some kind of decision to lift his flag.
It is. Yeah.
And you see him lift one hand halfway up. Then the other one halfway up. Then the other one, I think, a little, not as far up, but goes to lift that one up, and then eventually gives it to Atlanta, I think. But it's the fact that it seemed like no one knew what they were doing in these given situations. I mean, when it came to normal passage of play, they were fine. But it was in these unique situations where, you know, things were happening that sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't happen in soccer games. But it's stuff like that. I was like, oh my gosh, are we? Are you? How can you look so unprofessional as a group of referees? And that's exactly what it looked like. Just unprofessional. It looked like what you would see at like a.
In my league, man.
Yeah, like an adult league. It just looked unprofessional.
Yeah, and these guys are wide up and can talk to each other. I forgot about one man. I don't know if you remember in the first half, Cooper, I think it was Cooper, fouled Assad at midfield, was all on his back, and then Assad got up and was going to take the free kick quickly, and he just stood right in front of them.
Oh, yeah. And then
the referee played on.
He said, yeah, exactly. That is a yellow card every single time.
What? Or at least retake it. I've never seen anything like that, and it just blew my mind. It's not something I noticed the first time through because I'm not a professional referee, but if I went back and watched, and, you know, errors are one thing, but, like, I mean, I'll repeat it again. If you're making the same types of errors, I mean, that's just poor. That's really, really poor. And unfortunately, it completely, completely changed the game. I thought those last 15, 20 minutes were just going to be a real spectacle and completely ruined. Completely ruined.
By the time you guys listen to this, the Assad gif of him getting elbowed in the stomach should be on Dirty South Soccer if it isn't already. But – yeah, having missed that call and then eventually giving him the red card for what he did, you know, that's just an unlucky day for Yamil Assad and certainly unfair. I really hope that no further punishment is given to Yamil Assad because he doesn't deserve. Give him the one match ban, fine. I guess by the letter of the law, it is a red card because he did make some kind of violent motion and did touch the head of an opposing player. I guess by the letter of the law, that is a red card. Fine. I can live with that, that aspect of it. I don't like it, but I can live with it. But having missed Yamil Assad's blatant elbow, like that dude, that's a suspension for longer than a game. That's like 3 or 4 games suspended.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. If you come in with excessive force, I mean, yeah.
Just elbows him. You can clearly see he just elbows him. Like, no, there's no lead up. There's no trying to hide it. He just elbows him. As soon as Yamil falls to the ground, he tries to do the, oh, what's going on act. But no, you can clearly see on replay, he should get retroactively suspended for at least a number of games just based off that. And the fact that no one's called it out yet, at least I haven't heard anyone call it out yet, you know, that speaks to everyone missing it, except the ref, mm-hmm. who I saw point at the spot. We can complain about referees all day. We've had Mark Geiger at one of our home games, and we didn't complain this much. This is a special circumstances, so we're not going to complain about the referees every match. This is just a special circumstance where we had a really bad ref do some really weird things and ultimately led to a dramatic change in the game in the 75th minute.
Yeah.
The red card happened. Yeah. So, again, we're not going to normally complain about the refs, but in this instance, we wanted to bring to your attention not only all the missed calls, but Yamil Assad's elbow to the stomach, why he, I guess, technically deserves the red card. And just how bad the whole crew was altogether. And not from anything it was like all a bunch of little things that kind of gathered up and made themselves known. But
real quick, Eric, if you guys want to go more in depth on this, John Fuller had a great article on Dirty South Soccer about the red card. He's got video there. He breaks it down from a referee's perspective. If you want to, like, we could go on forever. We got other stuff to talk about. Great article. Go read it. Check it out. Really in depth. Good stuff. Made me really mad, though.
Coming up next, is Tito Villalba a winger? I'll tell you why he's not. Coming up next on the Mouth South Podcast on DirtySouthSoccer.com. Mouse This Out Podcast on DirtySouthSoccer.com. Eric Quintana, Josh Bagriansky, giving you the day after show. And we want to move right into Atlanta United's passing. We'll get into Tito Villalba and why he isn't a winger, in my opinion, in a little bit. But first, Atlanta United's passing. Specifically in the first half, atrocious. Almost across the board. No one seemingly had a good game, and the passing numbers indicate just that.
You've got some horrifying numbers, I know, across the board. The first half, to me, was hands down the worst half we played all year. I thought again, a list. There's a list of plays in the first half, individual mistakes, especially by the back four, by the center midfielders as well, in terms of giving the ball away, whether it be with botched clearances, poor clearances, misplaced passes, getting caught on the ball, basically everything you cannot do, especially against a team like Toronto. And we were very, very fortunate, in my opinion, just to be down a goal. I think it was 10 shots to one at the half, Toronto with more possession. And on top of that, I mean, Atlanta United playing with zero confidence. And they showed Tata a few times, and he looked legitimately horrified at what he was looking at. I mean, it was absolutely terrible to watch that passing. And it got better. It got better. We know that we're capable of better. We've seen it before. But it was seven or eight times where we just saw things that you should at the most see once or twice a game. From the back four and center mids. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, no, credit to Toronto FC for...
Oh, yeah.
They had a great game plan going in, obviously. Yeah. Greg Vanney had these guys well prepared. They knew exactly how to counter the high press, the style of play in the quick passing. They closed down on players almost as quickly as Atlanta United typically closed down on their opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw them struggle in the passing. Julian Gressel... it's only been five games, but this is without a doubt been the worst. It was the worst game he played. And the numbers speak for themselves. But especially in that first half, most of the game, you visibly saw that any chance he had to go forward, any pass he played going into the attack, not even into the attack, just going forward, almost every single one was a bad pass. Led to an interception, was straight to the defender, whatever the case may be, it was a bad pass. He had 37 total passes. 56.8 completion rate.
My God.
Or passing accuracy.
for a center mid. And only 37 passes in the entire match.
I mean, it doesn't get better. The highest number of passes from a player was 48 by Yamil Assad. And that's not even all that much.
No.
He had six long balls. I think only one completed.
There were several times I remember him trying to switch the play and basically
they just went straight to defender
or wide mid, just cutting that thing off with no problem and going the other way.
I want to say that Greg Vanney, what he told his team going into this game was, whoever is around you, whatever player is around you, you just need to be closer to them than you normally would be. Don't give them that space to receive the ball, gather the ball, and move it forward. Pressure them as soon as they get the ball, much like Atlanta United does. The only difference is that they weren't so focused on pressing super high. They were more focused on pressing in the midfield.
Yeah, I think you called it like a half press on the post.
It was like a delayed press, I think, is what I said, or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't even know if that's the right way to describe it, but that's just what I said at the time. But half press, delayed press, whatever. It's the same. Yeah. The passing in the midfield, the passing out of the back, horrendous from just about everyone.
I think one thing that's interesting and maybe one of the reasons we don't see a lot of foreign coaches like Tata Martino in the MLS is Tata Martino's style of play is very, very difficult for an individual player. And if you play in a league like the MLS, where there are some restrictions on how many players you can accumulate, obviously how much you can pay players, things like that, it's difficult to assemble a top-to-bottom roster of guys that fit that style. I think Atlanta's done a really, really good job with that. But what we saw on Saturday was how difficult that style is to play. So, and I think that's why you saw quite a few botched clearances out of the back that kind of looked like Parkhurst and Gonzalo Perez were kind of in between two minds, where they didn't know whether to put their foot through it and just crush it long or whether to try something a bit more cheeky and complete a pass out of the back. So I think, and I mentioned this on the post game, I think that's a blueprint when you play Atlanta. And if it's not working, you back off. But the key, I think, in the scouting report against us is going to be get in there, break up the possession, break up their play, force these guys into mistakes and put them into difficult positions. And Toronto's high press was great. By the same token, the individual errors, and you kind of bring it up with these passing statistics that were especially bad in the first half, were just terrible. I counted alone, I think it was four or five chances that came from just very, very poor on-the-ball play from a mixture of Gonzalo Perez, Parkhurst, Khan made a couple of errors, and Carmona and Gressel as well. And look, if you're not playing well through the middle of the field, Tata Martino's style doesn't work. It does. Yeah. I mean, he could have world class center mid. He could have the best team in the world. If you're not passing well in his system, it doesn't matter. And that's why it was just wave after wave in the first half from Toronto.
It seems like we're just slamming you with the negatives. There is a very good silver lining that we're going to save to the very end. So stay tuned for that. But there is a very good reason why we're bringing all this up and why this all matters now, and why there's a reason we're being so negative now. And it'll make sense later. But yeah, the numbers speak for themselves. A lot of people in the 60s in terms of their passing percentage, passing accuracy percentage. Tyrone Mears with 31 and 90%. Perez with 37 passes at 78%. And then mostly it's everything's Carmona with 42 passes at 83%. That's pretty good. But again, it was Almiron with 42 passes at 85%. But it's when those passes were made, it was, you know, clearly the passes going forward were the toughest for Atlanta for obvious reasons, because Toronto FC was doing a great job defending that midfield and keeping – really restricting what Atlanta United could do moving forward. But it was a lot of those passes moving forward. The pass from Tito Villalba to Almiron on the wing that was just a little too far. The passes that ultimately led to nothing. I can count on a number of instances where, on three instances, and we'll talk about this in a second, where Villalba gets the ball and it ultimately leads to nothing. You know, those are all passes completed that led to nothing because players individually couldn't get it going.
And that's why you see those just low, raw amount of passes even attempted from all the players on the pitch. I mean, that Chicago match, there were a couple times where there were 25 to 30 consecutive passes completed, and you're talking about guys like Miguel Almiron only even taking 42 passes within the one match. So that indicates exactly what you're saying, Eric, that when – approaching that final third or the attacking half, we're losing the ball very quickly, and basically you're seeing half of the passing statistics from your defensive half. But since there was so little possession in the attacking half, you just see not only low passing accuracy, but just a low amount of touches, overall touches, passes, crosses, all across the board for Atlanta United. And again, it's indicative of just an inability to control the tempo. Got way better in the second half, but the statistics you just went through, I'm sure if you just took the first half, they'd be even worse.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure. I mean, 10 shots to one, for Atlanta United against Atlanta United, that tells you the story. You leave down 2-1, the only shot having been a goal, the only shot on target having been a goal. That's not good. It's weird because I'm going to pick on Tito Villalba here. I know he scored both goals, and I understand that he was the man of the match, and he did a wonderful job. I'm not really backing down from what I said in postgame. I'm revisiting it. I'm not really changing my opinion, but I am revisiting, explaining it further. And I'm going to have a piece out hopefully tomorrow on Wednesday, Tuesday. Today's Monday, right? Yeah, on Tuesday. Basically describing in more detail what I'm talking about. There was three instances in which, and this goes back to, is Tito Villalba a winger? And I don't think so. Because the evidence just doesn't show that he is. It doesn't show that he's a good one, I'll put it that way. In those moments, there were three specific moments, three great passes by either Almiron or it was a turnover in the midfield that led to him having an opportunity one-on-one with the defender. In three different occasions, he's one-on-one with the defender on the wing in a position where he should, as a winger, be comfortable. And in all three of those instances, he did not look comfortable. He got dispossessed or whatever ball he played, in the only time he wasn't dispossessed by his defender, he played a bad pass to Almiron. It was basically behind him. He had to turn around and Almiron had to get a quick shot off, and it wasn't going to happen. There was one instance where he was a one-on-one with Michael Bradley, and we all know what Michael Bradley is. He is a solid soccer player. He's not the greatest defender in the world. He's not that hard to get by. He got dispossessed by Michael Bradley in a matter of a second. As soon as Michael Bradley got to him, he took the ball away from him. And it's almost it's not to say that Tito Villalba isn't good. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that maybe being a winger isn't his in his skill set. Maybe that's what he's been his entire life. Maybe he's been played in the wrong position most. What I'm saying is that, and it sounds bad, but most of the coaches, if he is a winger, most of the coaches have been wrong in his life. I don't think that's the case. I think with this team specifically, he is best suited centrally. We saw what he could do centrally. We saw how fast he is, how he can put his body in front of a defender and score and get the ball on frame and you know, hit a rocket into the net. You don't get those same opportunities on the wing. And every time he had an opportunity on the wing in this match, and honestly, in most matches that I've seen him in, he hasn't done well. Like, not by a long shot. Go back and look at his matches where he's one-on-one with the defender or was on the wing and he's trying to create something. He normally doesn't do well. He normally, the ball either goes out of bounds, he gets dispossessed, or he ends up, he ends up fouling the defender. In either case, he doesn't look good on the wing. And for someone, and it sounds harsh because I'm being harsh on purpose, because he's a designated player. Your designated players, you have to hold to a higher standard than the rest of the players on the field. Joseph Martinez has proved why he's a good designated player. Almiron has proved why he's a good designated player. Tino Villalba is yet to prove he's worth the designated player label. I know he's being paid the money for a designated player, a young designated player, but he hasn't lived up to that. Again, I understand he got three goals. He's got three goals in the last three games. The one in Minnesota was more a product of him being in the right place at the right time. He does a great job from a central position, from a central forward position, a more central forward position than he's played in previous games. Does great getting behind the defense, using his speed, tucking it away. He does the same thing on the long ball that kind of goes at is kind of going at an angle into the corner that he just rockets by the goalkeeper. Those are all great center forward plays. He's not going to have those same opportunities on the wing.
You mentioned Eric. You see him as a central player. I think we agreed on this, though. Maybe do you see him as a number nine, or is he an underneath guy for
you?
I don't think he's a nine. I don't think he can hold the
ball. No. I think he's a second striker. I think ideally in Montreal, if you're looking at your options and having seen Tito Villalba kind of perform as well as he did in that central position, again, he had two really good moments. I'm not going to sum up his career as an Atlanta United fan, as an Atlanta United player, based off those two moments, those two really good moments. He's got to prove to me over and over and over again that he can score from that central forward position as well and produce, if he's going to be on that wing, and produce as a winger. Right now, as a winger, he hasn't produced. As a central forward, we've seen a little bit, and we've liked what we've seen. I think he's a second striker. I think if he has someone he can play off of, that would put him in a better position than when he's on the wing. I think him having more space to kind of maneuver either way is good for him, because he just has not looked comfortable on the wing.
I can see what you're saying in terms of how his skill set for this team might fit more of a central role. Of course, the problem there is if you play him as a secondary striker, where does Almiron go? And I think we saw in Toronto, when you give Almiron that kind of technically he's a wide player, but he can come inside. But I thought that really hurt. That was one of the reasons we couldn't hold the ball, was because he wasn't consistently in the center of the pitch. He was allowed to roam. I think for me, Villalba, it's either wide, it's a false nine, or he's on the bench, because I don't see a way that Almiron, as the number 10, takes a back seat without going out wide. And we saw that the team in general was less affected with him there.
Maybe he doesn't need to be, a second striker. Maybe he just maybe needs to pinch in closer, more centrally.
That's a good point.
He's not so out wide. Yamil Assad, I would almost say the same thing, but then you've got three players playing in essentially the same position. That's not good. But specifically against Montreal, when you're looking at your options, and you saw how well, more importantly, you saw how bad he looked on the wing. I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. He just does not look good on the wing. And listen to games that we've seen him in the first five games, he hasn't looked good. He does look good centrally. Here, he did look in this last game centrally against a tough opponent, against tough defenders, against a tough midfield. He did look great when he was central. So I would like to see, I think ideally I'd like to see him and Kenwin paired up for against Montreal. Whether that happens is a different story, but I'd like to see it just to see what it looks like in the event that Yamil Assad is out, in the event that Joseph Martinez is out later in the year, whatever the case may be.
I certainly the solution might be, as you mentioned just a moment ago, when the team is at full strength and you kind of have to play Almirón at that number 10 position, that maybe Villalba looks to cut inside a little more or receive the ball a little more centrally so he can get into those positions where he's a little more comfortable. But it just surprises me because you tend to associate really fast pacing wingers with guys that are being the fullback one-on-one and then sliding the ball across the face of goal.
Yeah, he doesn't do that.
I can't figure out what exactly his style of play is as a winger, even though his pace is kind of naturally suited to that. I haven't seen any. And again, it's early, so let's wait and see. You know, we would
I'm not defining Tito Villalba based off these five games in any stretch. Yeah. Like, not
look,
at all.
All we can go off of it is what we see and what we've seen. And you know, I haven't seen any exceptional 1v1 play, technical ability. He has finished well.
I'll give him full credit for that. The two goals he scored, great. Awesome. I applaud you, Tito Villalba. You deserve the man of the match for having scored those two goals. The goal against Minnesota, where he was in the right place at the right time, great finish. Great finish. I can't deny those are great finishes. Those are great goals. I can deny anyone saying – I can basically object to anyone saying he's a winger because at this point I have not seen him do anything positive on the attacking end in the final third that would make me think he is a – good winger.
It's going to be interesting.
I'll put it this way. He's had, and I said this in the piece that hopefully comes out tomorrow, he can get there. He knows how to get there. He knows how to get into the final third. Once he's there, it's where he struggles. And it seems like every time he knows how to get there, he just can't finish once he's there. I need him to prove to, I almost want to say he needs to prove this to himself. He needs to prove this to the coaching staff that he's more than just a one-trick pony. He's more than just a guy that can run really, really fast. Because when he looked good against Toronto, he was just running really, really, really fast.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of – I mean, finishing, again, is a big deal. It's you got to actually put those balls on frame. You got to finish them. You got to, you know, you got to make them count. And I give him full credit for that. But we've only seen Tito Villalba at his best when he's just running full speed in a straight line. And that's not good enough for a winger.
No,
if that's where he's going to play, then we need to see more out of him, especially since he's got that designated player label.
Yeah, and especially since we've seen him as a left-footer play both sides. He's played both wings, which means Martino expects at times for him to cut inside and shoot.
Yeah.
And when he's on the other side, obviously, it's more of going 1v1 and trying to put in a cross. And it's difficult because the Martinez injury has really shook things up. From a shape standpoint in the attack.
Yeah.
But to me, I just mentioned this, regardless of where he fits best, when you have an Almirón and a healthy Martinez, if that guy's not cutting it on the wing, he's not playing. He's not, and I'm not saying that's going to happen, but a healthy Atlanta United, if you're not getting what you want from this guy on the wing, you know, you go with someone else. Let's give him time. I think it's important.
I agree. We should give him time. There's no need to rush, you know, anything. I'm not saying he needs to be benched, because his and Yamil Assad's work rate. And Yamil Assad hasn't had a great, outside of the first goal, he hasn't really had that great of a first five games either.
You could argue that the wingers have certainly in the attack been the weakness, so to speak.
Yeah.
We've seen flashes from Assad. We want a little more from Villalba, although we haven't seen as much of him in a wide position as we would like. But certainly those are the two guys that I think have looked, if you compare them to Almirón or Martinez,
right.
Those are the guys who have looked the least dynamic, the least dangerous in the attack. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, both Yamil and Villalba are do great work defensively on the wings. And in transition, they have shown very promising, you know, aspects of their game. It's once they get into the final third and once they're looking to make a decision either into the box or to take on a defender 1v1, that's where at least Villalba struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's evidence out there. Hopefully this piece comes out tomorrow and you'll be able to see it with your own eyes. The three different occasions where he just seemingly just did nothing with the ball once he got there.
And a team like Atlanta that – if you're going to control possession, you cannot allow a team to just collapse in the center of the pitch and just say, look, give it to your wide players. Let them throw crosses into the box. You guys aren't hurting us out there. So with the style of play that Atlanta plays, it is absolutely critical that Villalba certainly, but Assad also, that you see a little more from them in terms of final product in the last third, or teams are going to just – If they need to get behind the ball, they're just going to get super compact and just let those guys do what they want out wide because they're not hurting you from out there.
That might be a question I ask to Tata Martino if I get a chance, just to see what he says, just to see if maybe he's thinking the same things, that maybe he needs more out of his wide players because it just doesn't seem like they produce as much as the rest of the team has. I mean, you think about now, Assad does have one of the assists to Joseph Martinez. Assad does have a goal, you know, in the first five games.
And I think that he completed the most passes. Wasn't that a statistic we brought up from the last in Toronto? He was one of the few guys that had like a normal, relatively normal number. So he actually played.
Oh, yeah, no,
than
he
I
had the highest.
Did.
He had 72%, 73% with 48 passes completed. So that was.
Although I'd like to see where on the field those were. But,
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just – it's a wait-and-see game, but at five games in, you know, and against the toughest of opponents, the wingers – it's not that they're bad, because that's not what I'm saying. I just need to see a little more from them on the wing. If we're going to be a complete team and I mean, don't think – look, we're talking this way so negatively, and again, there's a silver lining here at the end, but we're talking so negatively – this is normal for great clubs. I produce a Real Madrid podcast, and they rip on their players all the freaking time. And I guarantee you all those players, regardless of what position they're in, are better than Atlanta United's players. And they get ripped all the time. This is what good teams have to deal with. And hopefully we're at that level now, five games in, where we can have these discussions, where we can talk about needing more out of Villalba on that wing, needing him to live up to that DP, you know, label that he has, much like Almirón and Martinez has. Martinez, three games, and he's hurt, and he's already living up to that name. I mean, that's what we need to see out of a guy like Tito Villalba.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel bad being negative, too. But
so
honestly,
do I. So do I. I really
this
do.
Is, this is the first time that we've really had a lot to be negative about.
Because it's been a pattern for the course of the last three or four games. You just don't see Tito Villalba taking on defenders one on one. You don't see him getting as involved in the attack. You don't see him, at least from the wing positions. Again, I understand what he did on Saturday. I understand he scored two goals. But you gotta take that into perspective as to how those goals were scored. They were both on runs made centrally. One goal, I don't know how it was missed, to be honest. Tito Villalba basically hit it straight at the keeper, and the keeper just completely whiffed it. I still credit Tito Villalba because he has to hit the ball. He has to put it on frame. He has to get it past the goalkeeper, and he
good
did all that.
Too.
He one-timed it off the run, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
He might have had one setup touch. Maybe. It was a good play. It was,
The second goal, it was a great run. Great to recognize that Perez was in a position to make that long pass. He runs by the defender, positions himself perfectly in front of that last defender and tucks it home. Those are all great, great moments for Tito Villalba, but they all happened when he's basically a central forward.
And it's just about taking the long-term view. I mean, there's a long way to go. Where is this guy going to fit? And obviously, lots of pace, played at a high level, you know, a good reputation, although hadn't gotten much first-team soccer over the last year when he came in. But where does he fit? Where does he fit in this system long term? And if he can't, I said it. If he can't make it work on the wings, I just don't see a place for him inside, regardless of how his skill set is set. That's just the way I see it.
I would like to see him, and I think many people would agree that I would like to see him paired up with Kenwin up top. I don't know what you do with the rest of the team. I just want to see what that looks like and how dangerous that can be. Because if it's open cup play and you want to rest, you know, Yamil Assad and Joseph Martinez for that game, you know, midweek game, knowing you have a game on the weekend, mm-hmm. you know, that might be a situation where you start Kenwin and you play Villalba as that false as that second striker. That might be the situation where you do that. Montreal seems like a good situation where a good scenario where you do start Kenwin Jones. And that's another discussion we can have maybe a later time. But Kenwin has also looked good in the moments he's in. He's held the ball up much like a target forward does, and having speed that Yamil Assad has, that Admiron has, that Tito Villalba has, you can use a guy like Kenwin to play off of him and work it into the gaps and make runs off of that. But we haven't seen that yet. It's not really Tata Martino style. Kenwin Jones isn't a Tata Martino hire. It's all stuff we've heard before.
Right.
You still would like to see something different in the event that Joseph Martinez maybe does go down for the rest of the year.
Right.
Yamil Assad is out for the rest of the year. Whatever the case may be.
Right.
You still want to see what else you have. And I think Montreal is a perfect example, considering that Joseph Martinez is out, considering Yamil Assad is out. Kenwin is there. Kenwin's looked good in the few minutes he's played. Let's give him a shot.
It's a little bit different, but certainly the pairing is good. And I think if you look at the goal, the opening goal that Sebastian Giovinco scored, the flick from Jozy Altidore, that's kind of a microcosm of what you get if you have a Kenwin Jones paired up with kind of a speedy, creative false nine.
I'm kind of glad you brought that up. Do you want to go ahead and dive into the goals that were scored against Atlanta United? Because they were pretty
Sure.
They were the first one was pretty bad. The second one, that happens every now and then. Yeah, Josh, go ahead and set up the first one for me.
Yeah, so basically it all starts Gonzalo Pires, again, making an error, overcommitting and fouling Giovinco in the center of the pitch. Toronto takes a quick free kick, and it's just chaos in terms of the positioning. So the main players, I mean, it's just an issue of not being the right place quick enough and not putting pressure on the ball. So the ball comes in from Vasquez. Not enough pressure on him. But the main thing you'll notice, so he plays it to Jozy. Jozy, beautiful little flick to spring in Giovinco for the goal. But Jozy is free in the middle of the box, and Parkhurst is pulled wide. I believe he's actually contesting the cross. Gonzalo Pires is with Giovinco. So Greg Garza has to slide across from the left and get in front of Jozy Altidore, and he has a good 2-3 seconds before the cross comes in to do that. He comes in way too late, so he's on Josie's back when the ball comes in, and then that's it. So that's easy for Jozy. I mean, he's a bigger, stronger guy than Garza. At the same time, as that ball comes into the box, you see Giovinco realize, you know, he's got a great hold-up player that he can play off of, like Kenwin Jones, like we just talked about. And Pires just doesn't react for a good 2 steps before Giovinco makes the run to the box, creating a really easy finish. So there was the foul, and then it was just really, really bad organization in terms of pressuring the ball and just being in the right position, anticipating where to be before the balls came in terms of the ball to Jozy, and then also the flick from Jozy to Giovinco.
Yeah, Jozy on that play, Jozy has what looks like at least 5 yards in any direction.
Yeah,
he's free, and Vasquez easily played. I mean, that's any you and I could go out there and make that pass. That's how open he was.
Oh yeah,
Garza is clearly out of position. He's staring. Ultimately, what it comes down to is the back line lost Jozy Altidore, and that's what leads to this goal.
Exactly.
Garza, like you said, should have been pinched over a lot more, basically on top of Jozy. Not saying that he eliminates the goal threat just by covering Jozy, because Jozy's still tall and Jozy is Jozy, and but you've got Larenowicz, who's kind of out of position, doesn't really, it looks like he's trying to keep Giovinco from cutting it back inside and being able to get a long shot off. Gressel is seemingly just watching the entire thing go on, which surprised me, because he's facing Jozy Altidore. And I'm assuming can see how open he is. And unfortunately, just either doesn't say anything or doesn't do anything about it. Garza, again, out of position. Vasquez plays that ball, like you said. Giovinco, his run is perfect, because as soon as Pires turns around to see who that passes to, Giovinco runs behind him. And that's what causes that delayed reaction from Pires. Giovinco's already behind him by the time Pires realizes he's on a run, Giovinco gets the ball, shoots, scores. It's a perfectly executed, 1-2 passing, flick play, whatever, 1-2 passing by Toronto FC. Great great vision and great ideas from Giovinco. I mean, that's a lot of playing time together. That's a lot of chemistry built up over the last couple of years between Josie and Giovinco, knowing that, you know, Giovinco will make that kind of a run. It's the defending. It's not, I'll put it this way, and here's the positive out of this. This is individual mistakes. It is not something tactical or something talent related, because we've seen them stifle stuff like this before. We know they know what they know they messed up. We know they messed up. They know why they messed up. This is not a, you know, they watch this replay and aren't surprised at not only the result, but know exactly what happened. And they're going to improve upon that. I have no doubt. I got like Perez probably pissed off that he got basically, you know, the run came behind him and he was half the reason that goal was scored. Garza's probably pissed off because he knows he should have been closer to Josie. Gressel, I'm sure, is pissed off because he was watching the whole thing. Lorenowitz seemingly out of position the entire way. It was a tough goal to give up, but that is a lesson learned, I guess, as to how to handle guys like this and to constantly be poor. I don't know how you leave Josie. Again, he has,
that's the thing.
Go watch the replay. He has five yards around in any direction. He's free.
That's the frustrating part about this goal is you'll know this is the exact type of method of attack that Atlanta United prepared for. You know, when you have a big target man up top and a number 10 in behind him, Giovinco, I mean, I'm sure Martino again was furious because I guarantee you that, you know, that's, you put a body on Josie with his back to goal every single time and you do it right away. And I think that's where they'll be frustrated. Again, we're not giving enough credit to Toronto. I thought they were fantastic.
No, yeah.
They were really good, but you know, we want to talk Atlanta. That. Yeah, you know, they were fantastic.
Again,
that was a great goal.
There is a silver lining in all of this, I promise. We're not just crapping on this team just to crap on this team. There is a silver lining at the end of this, I promise.
And it's the first time we've really done it, you know?
I mean, five games.
Yeah, exactly.
Even in their loss, the only loss they have this entire season, you know, the first game of Atlanta United history. You know, they didn't look as bad as they did today. And again, there's a reason we're bringing it up. So moving on to the second, unless you have something else, moving on to the second goal.
No.
Okay. So Lorenowitz on the second goal, he's trying to clear the ball and he ultimately doesn't clear it. I think in retrospect, he should have either just played out of bounds or really that's the only option he has. Play out of bounds, reset, reorganize your defense and see if you can't get out of the back once they've thrown it back in. He clears the ball. He tries to clear a ball. Goes straight to a Toronto FC player. They bring it down the wing. They bring it all the way to the end line. And once I think it's who took it to the end? Betashore took it to the end line. He just kind of slots it back into the middle of the box. And there's Morrow about 2 feet outside the goal. Easy enough. Mears is the one player. I mean, aside from Lorenowitz kind of failing to really clear the ball, Mears loses his mark, and that's Morrow is his mark. He loses him. It's pretty plain to see. He's on him the entire way, and Morrow does a great job of at the last second, as soon as right before that pass is played, he anticipates that pass being played, number one, and then cuts in front of Mears at the very last second because he's behind him, and then as soon as he's about to make that run, he cuts in front of him, and he's already beaten at that close. You know, there's nothing Mears can do. You know, I don't know. He was in good position. Morrow just made a better play on him.
Yeah, and that's a really difficult mark for a fullback. If the guy's coming from behind you and the ball is coming from the opposite side, that's a really tough mark to make. One thing I noticed on the goal, and I'd encourage a lot of people to go rewatch it because it kind of happened off the ball. After Lorenowitz has the awkward clearance and his involvement is seemingly done. He's on that touchline with Betashore, and Betashore makes a run all the way in from the touchline, ends up getting the assist, and he's virtually unmarked. And you can see Lorenowitz, it's a little weird. I don't know if he meant to hand him off to the fullback, but the numbers weren't working for that in that situation. And he just doesn't track him. And when you create that situation where you're seeing a player coming from all the way from the touchline to make a cross, for that fullback on the opposite side, it's really tough. And he should have done better, Mears, but it's really tough not to get caught ball watching because you're seeing this guy just basically approaching you for several touches. Or in this case, it was just I think it was Vasquez again. Who had the hockey assist there, and Mears just gets caught ball watching. So it's definitely Mears is part of it, but also you can't let Bedejor make that run from the touchline completely uncontested. So again, we have kind of an issue of guys not anticipating when they should be, which is something you'd expect to be fixed. They all know the error. They'll go watch the tape. They'll be a little bit upset about it, and it's something you would hope that they would fix. But
honestly, it's not so much anything they did wrong. It's more Toronto FC, their players, Morrow, Bedejor, Giovinco, Josie. They just, in those moments, played better. Josie being as open as he was is a mistake. I'm sure they've been drilled on that one. How you leave that guy open as open as he was, I don't know. But
yeah, The second goal, I thought, I mean, we can. I think we're being a little nitpicky. It was some
good combination
play. But the first goal was, I mean, Martino is going to be chewing someone out for that one. I mean, that was really bad.
It's still a good play by Giovinco running behind Perez as soon as he gets distracted by what's going on with Josie. Morrow with his run cutting at the last second right in front of Mears. No option. Mears can't do anything. The only thing he can do is foul him at that point.
And
he's already been beat. He is, he's literally 2 feet in front of goal. The other thing I thought may have been an option is Can kind of reaching out and poking it forward.
Mm.
Having watched it a couple times in replay, I think it might have been a little too far, so I can't blame him for not, making an attempt on the ball on that cross. Mm-hmm. I do kind of wonder at that angle maybe why he's so far forward. Maybe, I don't know. At this point, I'm just picking up the smallest of things. I don't think there's anything Can could have really done. I think this all starts with Lorenowitz not clearing the ball, and then the defense on that series. You saw Perez kind of get juked out before Bedejor makes that cross. That made a big difference. And again, the cut in front of Mears was beautiful. I think it's just a culmination of TFC players playing in those instances better than Atlanta United players. Atlanta United defenders, I should say. But, again, are you ready for the silver lining?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is, by far, in the five games they played, the worst Atlanta United collectively has played as a team.
Hands down. Especially the first half.
The worst. Yet, they went into the Eastern Conference champs, into their home, onto their pitch, and came out with the draw. Gutted out a point on the road against the Eastern Conference champs, and did it a week before against the Western Conference champs. At their worst, they still got it out of draw. This is the great thing about this team, is that even when they don't play well, you can still expect results out of them. You can still expect them to work towards at least getting that point on the road. These two draws on the road are great. And the fact that they played as bad as they did, as poorly as they did, speaks to how good these players actually are.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was actually something I mentioned in the lead-up to that game. Was we've obviously seen the best of Atlanta United, but you find out – it's cliche – but you find out how good your side is when things are difficult
things are bad,
and you're playing poorly. And the biggest positive for me, showing grit and all that, but was – the performance itself improved so much in the second half. I thought it was a genuinely even match. You start to see that Atlanta United possession controlling the tempo. Of course, then the ridiculous red card came out and ruined everything. But that was the biggest thing for me, was that you go into the break playing against the MLS Cup runners up from last season. Sixes and sevens in the back, 10 shots to one, could have easily been down 3-4-1. You're seeing individual errors everywhere. And we saw the team come together in the second half and play much better and score that goal right away and give a real response. So that to me indicates that in the long run, you can be confident, because you're always going to, over a long season, you're always going to go through poor runs of form. I think that we've seen to some extent in the Seattle match and certainly in Toronto that this is a side that can handle that pressure and still go out and get a result. And also, find their form when they really need to. Because that's one of the hardest things to do in soccer is when you're not in control of the tempo. The other team has the momentum. You know, you're tired. You're chasing them around. You're getting frustrated with your teammates. And for them to basically do a complete 180 in the second half and play a really solid style, I think it really shows the grit on the side and also what a world-class manager we have.
Yeah, no, he certainly made some adjustments. I think that basically him telling his team, and it was clear that he told his team, look, we got to slow it down. We're not going to win this game if it's as frenetic as it is in the midfield. Yeah. We got to slow this down. We got to put some passes together. We got to start connecting. I don't think it was as fluid as maybe Martino hoped it would have been in the second half, but they did get that second goal early, and they did they did enough to pull out a draw. And, I mean, they had chances for the win late.
Yeah, absolutely. And the defense was much better. I think one of the things you brought about bunkering in was the defense in the second half kept everything in front of them.
Yeah.
There weren't players running in behind. And most of that for Atlanta United is because you're solid on the ball. So you're not constantly in those positions where you're getting countered with over the top balls, with through balls, things like that. So the defense kept the play in front of them in the second half. We saw most of the Toronto FC chances were shots from outside the 18. And again, just the exact response you wanted. That was exactly what you couldn't do in the first half as a back four. We saw exactly what they should be doing in the second 45 minutes.
So these are the first two goals that, in my opinion, I'm going to consider me personally. I know that technically the own goal in the first against the Red Bulls was against the run of play or in the run of play, but these are the first two real goals, if you will, well earned goals by an opposing team that was in the run of play. Before that, it was all set pieces, or of course the own goal that I'm trying to think. It was the own goal, and then there was the corner kick. That was what it was, and then the penalty in Minnesota, and then these are the first five goals in five games. What does that make you think?
It's pretty darn good, man. Especially when you've gone to Seattle and now Toronto, and the opener against New York. I mean, you would expect that tally to be higher. Although, I guess the other side of that is Toronto did create a lot of opportunities. So maybe that's a little lower than it could be if they finish a little bit better. But I'd certainly say four of the five matches, solid back four. Solid back four. And I do think overall, yeah, they probably do deserve to be about giving up about a goal a game on the balance of their play.
I thought the 2-2 draw was even the 0-0 draw in Seattle, I thought those were fair results for Atlanta United. I thought they were unfair results for Seattle and Toronto.
If you had to pick a team, particularly, I think the Toronto match especially, really frustrated. They weren't way ahead the half. Seattle was such a weird game, but if you had to pick a winner from that match, 100%, it's Seattle. But that's a good sign for Atlanta. You know, you go on the road, you're going to be – if you draw on the road – against a top side, chances are, and not always going to be like this, but chances are the home side, who is also a top side, have created a lot of opportunities and certainly had their moments. So, you know, just by looking at the score lines alone and knowing the opponents and knowing you're in hostile territory shows that it was solid enough performance from Atlanta.
Yeah, solid enough, yeah. And that's you know, in your worst moments, you're just looking for solid enough. You're just looking to get out of there as best as you can, and the best they could. I think the best they could, on that day was, let's go home with the draw.
Let's put it this way: if we're super negative on a podcast and we have just come out with a point.
Yeah.
On the road.
That's a good thing.
That's happening consistently. That's good. That's a good, bad thing.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
It was great. Yeah. I agree. The grit, the response, I think it was great to see. And when they come here, it'll be a totally different ball game. I think you'll see kind of that opening to the match kind of flipped with Atlanta kind of putting their onus on the match.
They also want to be able, I thought Toronto FC, and we can just quickly do this real quick, but Toronto FC, I thought, really did a good job of spreading out Atlanta United and not giving them those easy 1-2 passes and just made life difficult, especially in the midfield, made life difficult for Atlanta United in the midfield. Atlanta United right now sitting in third place in the Eastern Conference, 13 goals for, 5 goals against. That is only two teams have better goals against numbers than Atlanta United. That is Orlando City, who is in second place right now with 9 points, Atlanta with 8 in third place, and Toronto FC, who we just played, with 4 goals against, 2 of which came at the hands of Atlanta United. So that's a good indication as to what. Look, at you got 13 goals for, 5 goals against, both at the top of the league in their respective category, or top of the conference in their respective categories. And I think even if you combine the Western Conference, they're second in terms of goals for, only down by 3 to Portland. Yeah. Portland, who's freaking on fire right now.
Yeah.
Portland
great.
Was 16. And outside of that, FC Dallas has allowed 2 goals. Sporting KC has allowed 2 goals. And that's it.
One thing you'll notice, though, Sporting KC and Dallas, Toronto, they're good with the goals against department. They've struggled to score goals.
Yep.
So I'd much rather be 13-5 than I think Orlando. They've conceded 3, but I think they're like a +1 or +2 goal difference. So
yeah, they've got
5, but you scored 13.
Orlando's got 4 goals for, 3 goals against. So again, that goal differential of 1. Atlanta United has the highest, tied for the highest with Portland. Yeah. With a goal differential of 8.
That's what it's all about. Yeah.
Yummy goals Minnesota has allowed.
just tell me how these poor guys. Just tell me before I give some terribly disrespectful guess and say like 40 goals. What is it?
In 6 games, they've given up 22 goals.
Oh my.
That's like 3.5 goals a game.
Oh my. Yeah. they have
a goal differential of -12.
Oh jeez!
And of course, they've
looked better the last. They looked better the last couple weeks. I guess RSL.
I'll say that I'm looking forward to that Atlanta United RSL game.
Oh yeah,
that should be a fun one to watch. I hope
something out of Montreal, like even a point, then I think you can be pretty good. Feel good about.
Well, I think the expectation from the front office. Yeah, the expectation from the front office is to come home with a point out of if they can come home with 4 points, that's a success. Any more, and that's just bonus.
A match, basically. Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that they can come away with more. They already have 2. I thought they could get at least 4. They need a win just to match that. And my hope is that they come out of this road trip with, at this point, let's see. Let's say they can get another draw in Montreal and get a win against RSL. That's at least, 6 points? No, sorry. I can't do math. Yeah, 6 points. 6 points out of this road trip. That is a phenomenal success, in my opinion. I think
Montreal struggling a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And anything better, assuming if we can get a win in Montreal, icing on the cake. I think RSL is I'm not going to say any of these teams are going to be easy. I think that RSL is a convenient opponent for Atlanta United at the time that they're playing RSL. RSL Agreed. Is struggling.
New manager.
They did look better under Petke.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they did lose to Minnesota United.
I heard a statistic. I know they won. There was another snowball over the weekend. I don't know if you saw RSL won it. I heard a statistic. I couldn't believe it. They said they hadn't won a match since like August or something. I mean, so they had just finished horribly last season, started horribly this season. I mean,
I heard it. I don't think I remember fully what it was.
It was unbelievable. I mean, they really, really struggled. That's a great way to finish the trip, though. You know, I mean, you lead off with 3 really difficult games. I know Montreal have struggled, but you'd expect them to find their form.
The thing is that they got talent, so I'm sure they can turn it on.
Yeah.
When they're ready, but they've got talent to be a tough
Montreal.
Opponent. Yeah. RSL, I think. I mean, I'm optimistic about the chances against RSL, but yeah, Montreal. I'm not going to say it's going to be as easy as maybe their record or their play right now indicates, because again, they could find their form this week and be off to the races with the talent they have.
They're excellent.
We're also, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're playing in the Olympic Stadium up there, which is terrible turf. So I don't know if that plays well into Atlanta United's hands. I mean, they've been basically playing on grass since they've been in Atlanta so far. So I don't know if it's going to be a challenge. They look good in Seattle, so maybe it's not an issue. We'll just have to wait and see. Do you have any final parting thoughts, Josh?
My main parting thought is we just saw the worst of this team, and we got a point against MLS Cup runners up. So I'll make no bones about it. I'm an Atlanta United fan. I'm a homer. I do my best to be objective, but I get more and more excited every week, even when I see this team play poorly, and that is a very good sign in the long run.
Agreed. I think that the silver lining is that as bad as they played against Toronto, it's not that they played just all 90 minutes were terrible. They just struggled against a quality team. a quality team, a team with more chemistry right now than Atlanta United. Not that I see, I don't think that's an issue. The chemistry as a whole, I think Toronto has more of it at this particular juncture in their season, considering how long some of those players have been playing together over the past couple of years. But they did not look great. They definitely did not look great going forward into the attacking third. And considering that, keeping that in mind, they still came out with a draw. And again, the silver lining is basically at their worst, in their worst game, in their worst moments, they still found a way to pull out a point. And that's ultimately what matters on the road. If you can get a draw at every away game, I think you're solid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
If you can shoot for a draw in most away games and you know, find the occasional win or a win every other game or something like that, even better. I think the minimum standard is to, you shouldn't expect to lose any road games. I think that happens naturally. I think coaches understand that happens, but you should expect to come out with a draw. Especially for a team like Atlanta United, that should be the minimum standard. Mm-hmm. You should be furious if you get beat by a team on the road in this league with the talent you have, and not furious and not concerned either. It's more
disappointed, though.
Yeah, disappointed, and just we could have done better. We should have hit on more opportunities, whatever the case may be. It's not necessarily that the opponent is going to play better. I think, in my opinion, with the team we've seen so far, it's not that the opponent's going to play better. It's that we kind of lose the game ourselves by not converting on our opportunities, by, you know, red cards, by, you know, like going down a man, by I don't know, by mistakes by Cam,
sure,
or by someone on the back line. It's you know, we just, again, we went into two super hostile environments against both conference champions, against both teams that played in MLS Cup last year and came in with the point. You know, we beat that horse to death at this point, but that is an important factor of this road trip.
That's the story of the road
trip
so far.
If honestly, I would be impressed if they lost both games, which I don't think is going to happen, but if they lost both games, I'd be disappointed, but I'd be impressed. I'd be more impressed with what they did against Seattle and Toronto. And I would, mm-hmm, I would use that as a platform to move forward with, to build off of those performances rather than, I think RSL is a win. I think Montreal might be a draw or a close win on either side, honestly. But but yeah, that's it. Anything else? You good?
Good to go, man. Ready for another one on Saturday.
So we will have a preview podcast later this week, possibly on Thursday, maybe even Friday. It'll either Thursday night or Friday morning it'll be available, and we're going to preview Atlanta United Montreal. We're going to try to get some a couple guests on to help us preview that match, and to hopefully give you a good set up the match well enough to where you know, you head into wherever bar you're watching, hopefully Fadeau Irish Pub in Buckhead, and either feel confident or feel well prepared and well feel knowledgeable in what you're about to see, and hopefully in how the team sets up and how they play.
Yeah. And come hang out with us. I drink.
Yeah, come say hi.
On the rocks.
We'll buy you a beer.
Jameson on the rocks for me, please. Yes.
I drink Goose Island IPA, and I drink.
Just don't spill it on me this time.
Yeah, that was might be. And don't be afraid to come say hi. We might look mean, but we're really not. I'm usually busy setting stuff up at the beginning, but as soon as I've set everything up, and as soon as the pre-game podcast is over, I'm all yours. I'm a fan just like the rest of you. I'm drinking beer. I'm celebrating. I'm yelling at the TV. I'm, you know, giving the refs the one middle, the one-fingered salute. I'm, what else?
Yeah, we're loving it just like y'all are.
I'm spilling beer. I'm spilling beer on Josh, all that good stuff.
Yeah. If Eric is setting stuff up, come talk to me because they don't let me touch that stuff. Trust me. If Eric's setting something up, I'm not doing anything.
That'll do it for us. Again, expect a pod later this week. Thanks to our sponsors, CrossFit Vesuvio, Fadeau Irish Pub. Go check them out in Buckhead, or really any of the locations. There's one in Midtown. There's one in Buckhead. Go check them out. Great food, great environment, great place to watch soccer, any soccer, if you're looking for a place in or around Atlanta or in the metro Atlanta area. That'll do it for us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, Atlanta, take it easy.